Underwood and Flinch, Blood and Smoke. Written and read by Mike Bennett. Episode 9. The recording began with Underwood speaking. He was in the middle of a sentence. "It doesn't do her justice, but still, she has an extraordinary voice, don't you think?"
"She does indeed, my lord. The audience loved her."
David surmised that they must have just returned from the underground station after Lady Underwood's debut performance. How many nights had passed since the previous recording, he couldn't say. But he found he felt pleased that things had gone well for her. Underwood continued. "Yes, didn't they? Just as they always have done. You should have seen her back in Berlin in the Weimar years, Flinch. She was quite stunning, and I don't just mean her voice."
"Oh, I could imagine, sir. She's still a very beautiful woman now."
"Yes, isn't she? Despite everything she's had to put up with. Damn shame it has to be this way, but at least she's happy now, even if it is only down there. That place has transformed her, Flinch. I was worried, as you know, about her mental fragility after we were caught outside in that air raid. Shell shock, I'd say it was."
So does that mean you're not worried any more, my lord?"
"About Rose? No, not any more. When she was avoiding me and refusing to come up here at all, yes, of course I was. I thought she'd lost her bloody marbles. No mistake. But now, well, I see she's herself again. She has friends, an audience who adore her. She's like she was when we first met. She didn't need me then. And certainly by the looks of things tonight, she doesn't need me any more."
"Oh, I wouldn't say that, my lord, but I do agree that the sheltering community down there is safe from her predations. It'd be an unwise entertainer, the native's audience."
Underwood gave a little laugh. No, that wouldn't be too clever, would it? But I'm very happy for her, you know, and relieved too. She can take care of herself, she's given me a blessing to go to war, and best of all, while I'm away, I don't have to worry that she's going to mess things up here."
"Oh, who knows, my lord, when we get back she might even be famous."
"Ha! Well, that would be a turn-up for the books, wouldn't it?" David heard the sound of ice cubes falling into a glass. "Anyway, let's get cracking on this recording of yours again, shall we? I'd like to enjoy a last London hunt later on, but it's still a bit early for that kind of thing. A little brandy and reminiscence will pass the time most agreeably."
"Yes, sir, the machine is on. Please begin whenever you're ready."
The sound of Underwood's leather-upholstered seat taking his weight, the chink of a cigarette lighter followed by a sharp inhalation, and then Underwood sighed. "So, where were we?"
"You were at the point where you had just retired for the day, having just got the treasure chest aboard the Desdemona."
"Ah, yes, so I was. Right, well, let's see. We sailed north, following the Turks and Caicos Islands. The route was infested with pirates, and we kept a constant vigil for any signs of the scum. Catesby said he knew most of the pirate ships on sight, and a number of them knew his ship too. So, for the most part, he said, he knew who to run from and who to yield to. Well, I told him in no uncertain terms that we wouldn't be yielding to anyone. I'd sooner go down like a bloody Dutchman than let them get their hands on my booty. But anyway, it was a long journey, and I whiled away the nights talking mostly with Matthias and Maru. We'd each swap stories, share confidences, you know, that sort of thing. Just getting to know each other, as one does. Matthias continued to school me in the fine art of becoming Lord Daniel Underwood, coaching me in matters of speech, etiquette, and so on. And he also taught me how to read and write better. I'd been able to get by before, you understand, but only in a very limited fashion. Matthias taught me how to read and write as a gentleman should, scratching away with a quill in Catesby's cabin, copying out letters and joining them together in my first attempts at fancy handwriting. By the time the journey was over, I was pretty good at it. I'd even cultivated a signature, signing my name with a flourish as Daniel Underwood. I was delighted. It was almost as empowering as being able to fly, but not quite. Arthur gave an appreciative laugh before Underwood went on. In the daytime, while I slept, Matthias taught Maru how to read and write too. He'd never had a chance to learn at all, but Matthias was a gifted tutor and soon had him turning pages and reading aloud. I think our textbook may have had something to do with it. I remember it was the only book on board, a very well-worn, racy romance called Emily Escapes, one of a series, apparently, though I never caught up with any of her other adventures. It belonged to one of the sailors. He used to read it aloud to the other crewmen, who all loved it dearly, as did we. He laughed at the memory. Oh, she was a one, was Emily. Splendid read. I tell you, Flinch, if they used books like that in schools these days instead of Shakespeare and whatnot, the rise in literacy standards would be dramatic.
Indeed, my lord, Arthur chuckled. Most edifying, I'm sure.
But anyway, reading and writing were all very well, but there was something of far greater importance to me, and for that I looked to Maru as teacher, for it was he who knew the ways of vampire. So, every night, Maru would share that knowledge with me, answering my questions whenever he could, and making educated guesses whenever he couldn't. He was quite the mystical sort, was old Maru. He taught me about his religion, Vudan. The word actually comes from their word for God, and its pantheon, or lower, of spirits. I was fascinated, naturally, because at that time, of course, I thought I had something in me that was actually a part of that lower. As I've said before, Christ, it seemed, had scorned me, and for no good reason that I could discern. So I had this ever-growing anger and resentment towards him, you know? If he hated me, well, the feeling was becoming decidedly mutual. However, meanwhile, within the framework of Maru's religion, I felt myself more at home. It was a religion that embraced the natural world, earth, wind, fire and water, love, death, even sex. Everything had its place and its own representative spirit, and everything was celebrated as part of life. Vudan gave me that sense of decency again, a sense of validity, a justification for even being alive at all. Can you see that? Oh, yes, sir. It sounds like Maru was, pardon my choice of words, quite a blessing for you.
Yes, he was indeed, Flinch. When we were between the islands, our conversations would take place on deck after the crew had all turned in for the night. But when we were moored in some sheltered island bay, we used to take a rowing boat and head in to one of those beautiful long white beaches. There we'd make a fire, and once we were sat facing each other across the flickering flames, he'd lead me in a mantra through which I'd quest deep within myself to seek and touch the spirit of vampire himself.
Arthur cleared his throat.
Beg pardon, my lord, but what's a mantra?
A mantra, Flinch? Surely you know what a mantra is.
Is it a kind of fish, one of those flat ones?
That's a manta ray, you clod! Honestly, Arthur, a mantra is an incantation, a chant through which one is able to journey within oneself and find harmony with the universe.
Ah, said Arthur, I see.
Do you?
No, sir, not really.
All right, let me rephrase it. We sat and repeated certain phrases over and over again, losing ourselves in the flickering flames and the sound of the chanting. I didn't understand the words I was saying, but that didn't matter. I trusted Maru, and together we journeyed within. And then, one night, it was like piercing a veil within my mind. I reached him.
A vampire?
Yes. Well, so I believed at the time, anyway. And through him, I found I was able to locate my animal forms, merging with them mentally, seeing through their eyes, feeling their bodies as my own. I told Maru of this afterwards, and he told me that now all I needed to do was to will them into being, and then they and I would become one flesh. And so, the next night, I tried it. Before I settled down, I removed all my clothing, as I knew from experience that they would combust with the heat of my transformation, and I didn't want to be sitting in a pile of burning rags if and when it happened. And then we began. In the depths of my mind, I sought and found the wolf. We joined as spirits, becoming one within. And then, as Maru had told me to, I willed us into being. I awoke from my trance, but when my eyes fluttered open, I was still seeing through the eyes of the wolf. The transformation had taken place. Maru had felt my transformation in the air rather than seen it, and he awoke to face this large black wolf where his friend had been sitting earlier. But he wasn't fazed in the least. He spoke to me in his native tongue, believing that I could understand him, and that once again he was face to face with vampire. I watched him through the flames, letting him say whatever it was he needed to say, and when he'd got it all off his chest, I got up and came around the fire to his side. He was wide-eyed, afraid, unsure, he later told me, of just what was going to happen. I licked his face. It was salty, but I liked it. What can I say? I was a canine. We like that sort of thing. Arthur laughed. Oh, he must have been most relieved, my lord. Oh, he was, yes. After a moment or two, he started laughing himself. He told me that of the two spirits within me, mine must now be the stronger. Hokum, of course, but music to my ears at the time. After that, I experimented with other transformations, and besides the wolf and the bat, I also managed to achieve the disembodied state, the incorporeal mist of my molecular structure in between its physical forms.
Oh, and what did Maru say about that, my lord?
Well, remember what he'd called me when he first had an inkling of what I was, a creature of blood and smoke? Well, this was the smoke, the spirit smoke.
Oh, spirit smoke. That was his term for it.
Yes, makes sense, don't you think?
Oh, indeed, sir, yes.
Anyway, putting all the voodoo mysticism aside, Maru was quite right about one thing. I had indeed mastered the challenges of my new and various forms. And it was just as well, too. We'd had a soft ride of it so far, but no sooner had our ship come within sight of the Florida coast than our luck ran out. I was asleep, and Matthias shook me awake. I knew it wasn't yet evening, as there was light still coming in around the door, and the smell of sun-heated decking was rich in the air. I was confused, and asked him what the hell was the matter.
"It's pirates, John," said he.
"A few miles off the stern, but they've seen us. Catesby wants to surrender to them, and so do the crew."
I came awake in an instant. "Well, to hell with that idea," I said. "He may have nothing to lose, but we do. Christ, I'll bet he surrenders every bloody time. Offers up his passengers and their valuables to the pirates, and then they throw him a cut, and he's off on his way again. Pirates or no pirates, either way, Catesby wins. Well, he's not surrendering us, I can promise you that." I told Matthias to send Catesby in. He did, and I had the rotten-nosed bastard up against the wall as soon as the door was closed on the sunlight. I told him, eyeball to eyeball and with a fascination fired by fury, that he was to outrun them, or I'd outrun his entrails all over the deck. He submitted, obviously, and swore to obey, but maintained that he still had some reservations as to whether we'd make it. Their ship was a brigantine, square-rigged on both masts, and he'd seen through his spyglass that they were higher in the water than we were. A light load, and light meant fast, especially with that much sail. "Then chuck stuff overboard," I told him. "Chuck men overboard if you must, but don't let them catch us." I told him that Matthias was in charge until sundown, and then I, personally, would take over. I dismissed him.
But as he was heading for the door, he mumbled under his breath that to mess with Verlaine like this was bound to end in trouble. Well, the sound of that name was like a kick in the kidneys. "What?" I demanded. "Who did you say?"
"Verlaine, the pirate,"
says he.
"That's his ship, the Fortuna. What's following us? I seen his flag in my spyglass, the skull and axes. He's always in these waters. He's a reasonable enough feller if you do right by him. But if you runs or tries to fight..."
Well, he let the sentence hang in the air for our imaginations to finish, but we didn't need to imagine. We knew only too well. "Well, we are going to run, and if necessary, we are going to fight. So you'd better sail like your life depends on it, Catesby, because one way or another, it does." I sent him out. When he was gone, I gave Matthias orders to wake me the instant the sun was down, and in the meantime to ready all the weapons on board for combat. With a brave smile, he saluted and went out. Once he'd gone, there was nothing for me to do but lie down and try to sleep. But my mind was ablaze with thoughts, stitching together battle plans, contingency plans, and contingency plans to my contingency plans. And by the time Matthias returned at sundown, I'd worked out something I thought might just work. I was already up and dressed when he arrived. He told me the pirates were gaining on us, which wasn't news, as I'd heard as much repeatedly shouted from the deck. I strode to the stern, and my heart quickened unpleasantly at the familiar sight of the Fortuna. Matthias joined me, and I asked him at what rate Verlaine was gaining and when we'd be within range of his forward cannon. He said he reckoned if they kept after us at the speed they were, we had about an hour at most. "Fine," said I. "That gives me plenty of time to prepare our welcome." He asked me what the game was. Now, I knew he'd have his objections, but since he was a crucial part of the plan, I told him. "One of the things I considered when I was trying to figure out what to do," I said, "was you, me, and Maru taking off with the treasure in a rowing boat, hoping that the cover of darkness would allow us to escape unnoticed." He shook his head. "No way. They'd spot us. And the only reason anyone would try and escape like that is if they had something worth risking their lives for, something they'd surely be taking with them." "Exactly," said I. "Now, they must already suspect that we've got something on this ship, otherwise we wouldn't be running. At this range, their lookout in the crow's nest would easily spot a rowing boat sailing away from us. And if that rowboat were heading for the coast, so much more likely that whoever's in it is trying to get away with the booty under the cover of darkness." He nodded. "Right, it's a bad plan. So, that aside, what is your plan?" With a grin, I said, "That is my plan." I went on to explain the rest of it to him, and, as I'd expected, he was dead against it. He said he preferred a straight fight, which is all very noble, but not very smart. "Matthias, what chance do you think we stand against that ship, that crew, with this one, eh? You know Verlaine's armaments, his men, and his tactics, so you've got to know that we are no match for him. If he catches us, and he will catch us, then we're done for. Remember, we broke our contract with him. We fled his ship in the midst of battle, and we killed the men he sent after us. Do you think Verlaine's the type to forgive and forget?" He didn't like it, but he knew I was right. So, reluctantly, he agreed to go along with my idea. Arthur said, "And what was your idea, milord?" "Patience, Flinch. I'm getting to it. I went to Catesby and told him to ready a rowboat and to stash a keg of gunpowder aboard it as well. As he went about that, Matthias and I went and told Maru the plan. Now, he liked it, probably because he had a better understanding of what it was I meant to do. Then Catesby came back to tell us that everything was in place. I fixed his eyes with mine and bored the command into his brain that once Matthias and I were off the ship, he was to take his orders from Maru. And then we were ready. The Fortuna was closing with every second, and there was no time to lose. Matthias and I boarded the rowing boat. I opened the powder keg and shook out a fair amount into the bottom of the boat. The sea was calm, so there wasn't much chance of waves sloshing over the side and soaking it. and then finally I poured out a little well of powder under the seat at the back of the boat and settled the keg into it, hiding it from view. Matthias and I took an oar on either side, and I gave the order to lower us away. Had it been light, the lookout on the Fortuna might have been able to see what we were up to, but it was a moonless night, and we were still at enough of a distance for our actions to have been obscure at best. Indeed, there was a good chance we hadn't even been seen at all, and that was my big concern as we rowed away from the Desdemona towards the distant coastline. We rowed with our backs to our destination, and were able to see both ships. Both of us wore darkly coloured shirts, because had it been a real attempt at flight, then that's exactly what we would have done. However, as the Desdemona grew further and further away and the Fortuna showed no signs of changing course, I began to wish I'd had us both wear something white. Of the two ships, the Fortuna was now the closer. I could clearly see Verlaine's skull and axe's flag flying high aloft the main mast. "Come on, you bastard!" I cursed under my breath. "See us! See us!" Then, as if in response, from the side of the ship came a flash of light in the darkness, and the sound of a shot travelled across the water. "A warning shot," said I. "They've seen us! Row like hell!" And row we did, giving it all we had as the bow of the Fortuna slowly turned after us. I could just imagine Verlaine getting all excited, having spied a couple of pigeons in flight. There was another flash of a musket, and another distant report rolled to us across the waves. Then another, and then another. Now the musket balls were starting to splash down into the water closer behind us, and we knew we'd soon be in range. "Get ready, lad," I said to Matthias. We could hear distant shouts, the clanging of a bell, the sound of the ship carried on the ocean breeze. I wondered if Verlaine would have his drummers strike up their battle tattoo for such a little fish as we. Was he watching us now? Or in his cabin, readying himself for his grand entrance, all glad rags and polished axes, the consummate showman, or rather, show off. Huh! I sneered then as I sneer now, the great doxy. Then another shot fired, the muzzle flash and report in almost perfect harmony, and I heard the musket ball whiz past my head and splash down somewhere ahead of us. We were in range, so we stopped rowing, tired and panting, and waited as the ship closed upon us. I could see men lining up along the bow. I could even recognize some of them. Dixon, Gwent, old Davy Fisk, and then they were laughing, and I could hear our names being shouted back and forth. I smiled at Matthias, the kind of smile that says, "Oh, well, we gave it our best, but it looks like we're toast now, old chum." However, under my breath, I said, "Wait until they're right on top of us. I'll tell you when." And then there he was, Verlaine, smiling down at us like the cat that got the cream. "Well, well, lads," he shouts. "Looks like we've caught a pair of our old chickens. John Brooks and his little boyfriend out for a romantic paddle." A roar of laughter went up at that. Then Verlaine called down, "Where are you two lovebirds going at this hour of the night? You wouldn't be trying to give us the slip now, would you?" "Verlaine," I called, "why don't you just turn that ship of yours around and fuck off?" I was delighted when that got a bigger laugh than his comment. Even he himself laughed. More of their number had gathered now. 7, 9, 12. The more the merrier, I thought. "Keep coming, shipmates." "Oh, we'll fuck off, all right, Brooks. But with you and young Mr. Flinch there hanging by your thumbs from our yardarm. And whatever you're hiding there, plus everything worth having on old Catesby's ship, safely stowed in our hold." That occasioned more laughter from his rabble, but I turned to Matthias and said, loud enough for them to hear, "Swim for it, lad!" Without a word, he dived over the side and started swimming away from us for all he was worth, and that got the biggest laugh of all.
"Where is he off to?"
someone shouted.
"Davy Jones' bleeding locker!"
laughed another.
"Flinch!" shouted Verlaine. "Come back here! We need a fiddle player! I'll spare you, boy!"
But Matthias kept going.
"Last chance, Flinch!" called Verlaine. "You'll never reach dry land from here. And even if the devil did save your hide and set you down in Florida, it'd only be for his amusement. There'd be dragons there, boy. You ever seen an alligator?"
"Better food for dragons than a slave under you, Verlaine," I said.
That brought his attention back to me, which of course was what I wanted. Our vessels were drifting together now. I was still just a little ahead of the Fortuna's bow and looking practically straight up into Verlaine's face. He aimed his pistol down at me.
"Are you going to come aboard and face justice like a man? Or am I going to shoot you down like the worthless cur you are?"
"Fuck your justice," said I. I was saying all this to keep him distracted, to give Matthias more distance. The lad was far enough away now, but if I could get him another few yards, then so much the better. That was when Verlaine shot me. He aimed low and hit me in the thigh. I cried out and fell down in the boat.
"Go get him, boys,"
Verlaine commanded, and two or three of his men immediately jumped overboard. I lay there on my side, the rich smell of gunpowder all around me, hearing the men splashing down and knowing they'd be clambering aboard at any moment. And then I rolled onto my back so Verlaine could see my face as I started laughing up at him. Oh, he didn't like that. He took a flintlock from the man next to him and pointed it down at me. Again he was aiming low, maybe wanting to hit my other thigh, or maybe my groin. I'll never know if he actually fired, because I closed my eyes and summoned the bat, merging with it in my mind and launching myself up into the night, aware of the heat of transformation and knowing that my clothes, peppered with gunpowder, would be falling away from me like the feathers of a fiery phoenix, back down to the boat and the powder keg that nestled in its bed of gunpowder. My wings unfurled as I climbed above the Fortuna, and I glanced down into the terrified face of the man in the crow's nest. It was the last thing I saw before the explosion ripped through the bow of the ship. I felt the heat and force of the shockwave, rising with it, riding it like a seagull in a thermal. Then I banked away, swooping out of the cloud of smoke to look down at the Fortuna. She was sinking fast, the stern now completely clear of the water as she flooded at her shattered bow. Men were running frantically to the stern, some trying to release a rowing boat, the smarter ones just throwing themselves overboard to avoid going down with the undertow. And there, standing defiant, watching me as his desperate men ran all about him, was Verlaine, his clothes charred and his face bloody. He raised his pistol, tracked me through the sky, and fired. Oh, he missed by a mile. He shouted something incoherent, a roar of primal rage, and then he lost his footing as he and everything else on deck started to slide. Ha ha ha! I flew up and over the ship as she rolled onto her side, her masts breaking like matchwood on the waves. And for a moment I lingered, watching as the pirates abandoned her, swimming for their lives. Should I have cared? I didn't. I banked away and went after Matthias. I could see him treading water a good distance from the soon-to-be wreck of the Fortuna. I swooped down, snatched him from the waves, and headed back to the Desdemona. As I approached, the sight of me, this bat creature, coming out of the dark, sent the men on deck hysterical with fear. They started scrambling for weapons, and nothing Moreau could say would quell them.
Quickly, I landed and returned to my human form, hoping it would bring them to their senses. But if anything, it had the opposite effect. Muskets, flintlocks and swords were all being raised against me, and on an impulse I threw out my hand and commanded them to stop, my eyes meeting all of theirs in a long, sweeping gaze. "Weapons down, boys," I said. "The enemy is vanquished. You have no further cause to fear me, if ye do as I command. Indeed, I'll reward you like none ever has before. But the first man to raise a hand against me will lose that hand, then his head, and then his very soul. For I am no mere mortal, shipmates. I am Vampire. Serve me or die." Well, as you'd expect, there was a pause as this sank in, but after a few moments, all weapons were lowered. However, I wasn't content with this. I wanted more. Not just for reassurance, but because, well, I liked it. "Kneel," I commanded. "Kneel before Vampire." And then, one by one, they dropped to their knees and bowed before me. They were mine. Every man jack of them. Arthur cleared his throat.
"They feared you as a god, my lord?"
I think not as a god. Their minds were too set in the Christian tradition to admit of anything other than one god. But as a demon, oh yes, they feared the arse off me. Matthias laid his hand on my shoulder and said, "John, the Fortuna, we should go back for the survivors." Well, I was surprised at this because I thought he'd be delighted they were all getting their just deserts. But no, not a jot of it. He said it was the law of the sea, that we couldn't just leave them there to drown. Well, damn the law of the sea, I told him. That might have been what they taught him back in the Royal Navy, but it wasn't any law that Verlaine respected. "Do you think he'd do the same for you?" I asked. "If he did, it'd only be so he could flog you to death before chucking your body over the side again." As you might have expected of Matthias, he argued, belly aching on about how they were human beings and how we needed to set them an example, and so on. Well, there was no way I was having any of those curs anywhere near my treasure. Oh, no. But I'd set them an example, all right. I took a musket and went to the stern where Matthias was pointing to where the men were now swimming towards us. I raised the gun and fired at them. They were out of range, but my message was clear. Matthias was horrified. "Understand this, boy," I said. "They're pirates. We've deserted them, killed their mates, and now we've sunk their ship. If you expect anything from them other than revenge, then you're a damn fool." I handed the musket to Maru. "If they keep coming, shoot at them until they stop." Then I turned and shouted to the men, "Set the sails, boys. Let's be on our way." Matthias then started shouting out names. Names of the men on Verlaine's crew that had been decent fellows, many pressed as we had been. "What about them, John? Are you going to let them drown too? They were our shipmates, our comrades." Well, he had me there, but I wasn't going to let him win. I turned back to him and said, "Not any more." I thought that would give me the last word, you know, shock him, scare him into submission. But I was wrong, for it was he who scared me. He came up to me, right up close to my face, and in a voice that was just meant for my ears, he said, "What have you done with my friend?" I was taken aback. I asked him what he meant, and he said, as if he was speaking to someone else, someone behind my eyes, "He's dead, isn't he? He's dead. And now there's just you." Again, I asked him what the hell he was on about, but he just shook his head and walked away. I wanted to go after him, but Maru stayed me with a hand on my shoulder. "Let him go, John. But what the hell is he talking about, Maru? I can't let him just go off with that.
He sees only what you show him. For him, John Brooks is dead. Now, there is only Vampire.
I was stunned. I thought Matthias, of all people, would have understood, would have realized that what I was doing and all that I'd done was for us, for our safety and our future well-being. But I was wrong. It seems I'd played the part of the monster too well. Then, from far behind us, a scream split the night. We went back to the stern and looked to the flotsam of survivors. There was a rowing boat full of men, others clinging to the sides. Some men clung to barrels and others to debris. It was hard to tell how many among the floating were alive or dead, but there was a commotion at the edge of them. They were shouting, panicking. Maru said it just as I realized what it was. Sharks. Death has come for the last of them. I turned away and accosted a crewman whom I knew played the squeeze box and told him to strike up a tune. He was shaken, fearful. I seized his face and bore my eyes into his. Don't make me tell you twice, mate. Strike up a tune and make some merry, or I'll have you thrown overboard. He didn't need to be told twice. Underwood fell silent, and David listened intently for his next words. Through the hiss of the old recording, he could make out the occasional crackle of the open fire, the distant ticking of what he imagined must be a grandfather clock. Then Underwood sighed and said, "I'm not proud of what I did, Flinch, but there was no doubt in my mind at that time, none whatsoever, that bringing any of Verlaine's crew aboard would have had dire consequences for us. There were simply too many of them for me to control. There was nowhere to hold them under lock and key. It was a terrible decision to have to make, but at that time I felt it was the right one. Have I questioned it since, you may ask? Yes, of course I have, many times. And the thing I wonder most is, were my motives really only just keeping us and our investment safe? Or did I, in some dark place in my psyche, want to do it? To leave those men to the mercy of the sea? There was a pause. Then Arthur asked,
Did you, my lord?
I honestly don't know, Flinch. If they'd all gone down quickly with the ship, it would have been easier. I doubt I'd have ever given it another thought. But in the time between that first scream and the time it took for the sailor to finally find his squeeze box and smother the screams that followed, it seemed an eternity. And my hearing is so damned acute, you know?
Yes, my lord.
The gentle splash and gurgle of what David assumed to be brandy into a glass. Underwood took a drink, then continued. Anyway, for the remainder of the journey, Matthias and I barely spoke a word to one another. Thankfully, our contrasting hours of wakefulness made the uncomfortable silence between us more bearable, until finally one night I awoke to find us anchored off the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia. Maru told me how we'd arrived hours before, but had stopped there on Matthias's orders. I was puzzled, so I went to seek him out. I found him playing pitch and toss with a couple of the men. He'd been drinking, which is something he'd taken to over the past few nights. I asked him why he'd done it, waited here, offshore, and not just sailed the ship into port. He looked at me and said, "Because that's what John would have wanted. He'd have wanted to see the place he'd fought so hard to get to. He'd have wanted to be at the bow when we finally sailed to our journey's end." His posture was defiant, chin up, shoulders back, like he was issuing a challenge to a duel. But his eyes, maybe it was just the rum, but they glistened with the tears I felt he was fighting to hold back. tears for the friend he believed he'd lost.
What do you say to such a thing? I certainly didn't know. I wanted to reassure him, argue with him if necessary, do whatever it took to convince him that I wasn't lost, I wasn't dead, that I was still John Brooks, his friend, just as I always had been. But I didn't, because at that time I honestly didn't know if, after all, maybe he was right. So I didn't contradict him, I merely nodded, thanked him, and walked away.
Underwood sighed.
Let's leave it there for tonight, Flinch. We were down on the station for longer than I'd expected, and you've got a lot to do tomorrow.
Yes, sir. I've a few people I could...
The recording ended abruptly.
David came back to full awareness to find himself staring at the dark screen of the monitor, which had long ago gone into sleep mode. He tapped a key on the keyboard to wake it, and saw the MP3 had finished. So, that was it. Underwood's journey to the new world had ended, and on such a note that David was half tempted to click the next MP3 to find out how things went from there. Did his relationship with Matthias improve, or did they stay that way for years to come? And then there was Martha. What had happened to her? How would she take to being rescued from penal servitude, not by her beloved John, but by this being that he now thought himself to be? And how long would it take before Underwood actually copped on to the fact that he wasn't a god, that vampire didn't exist, and that he was still just a man who'd had the bad luck to be turned into a supernatural being? David reached for the mouse to click on the first recording of 1946, but in the dark his hand nudged the beer bottle that stood right beside the mouse mat, upsetting it and spilling the last of the contents across the desk.
Shit, he murmured. He righted the bottle and considered the pool of fizzing liquid that now dripped down onto the floor. He knew he should clean it up. It'd stink in the morning if he didn't. But the thought of doing housework sent a wave of overwhelming tiredness through him. No, it was late. He needed to get to bed. He pushed his chair back from the computer, got wearily to his feet, and went to the door. There, he turned back to the computer, and with a wave of his hand said, "Good night, my lord. Until tomorrow." He was pulled from sleep by an angry, intermittent buzzing. He opened his eyes. The room was dark, but the light from his phone on the nightstand was glowing in his peripheral vision. The LED on the bedside alarm clock told him it was just after 2 a.m. The phone buzzed again, demanding his attention. He reached out and picked it up. Who the hell was calling him in the middle of the night? From the small screen, Lisa's face smiled at him, a picture he'd taken not long before he'd left Brighton. Guilt flooded him. He closed his eyes and fell back onto the pillows. The phone continued to vibrate insistently in his hand. He was amazed that she was still bothering to call him. He hadn't taken a call from her since he'd come out here. Once he'd decided to resurrect Underwood, the idea of speaking to Lisa in person had felt wrong, as if opening a direct line to her might somehow contaminate her with the evil of the world he now inhabited. Initially, his only replies to her voicemail messages had been brief texts. Then, as things with Underwood had grown increasingly dangerous, he'd continued to listen to them, but stopped replying. Eventually, he'd just stopped playing the messages altogether. But now, Underwood was dead. Lydia was dead, and the evil of this world had gone with them. He opened his eyes, seeing her again, smiling at him, and was just about to take the call when he stopped. What of himself? Wasn't he now part of the evil? Hadn't he embraced his role as Underwood's guardian at the end? Hadn't some part of him even relished it? It was a question he'd considered for a long time, lying in his cell in Malaga in between interrogations. Maybe he deserved to be in jail for what he'd done, or if not in jail, at least banished from the company of decent people like Lisa.
The phone continued to throb in his hand. Damn it, no, he deserved to be happy just as anyone else did. He was done with Underwood and done with David Finch. He could go back to being good old David Smith, English teacher, clean and sober and living in Hove with, assuming she would still have him, Lisa. Before his mind could argue, he pushed the receive button. Hello? At first, there was no reply, but he could hear the line was open. There was something in the silence at the other end, tiny sounds floating in the soft hiss, indefinable. It was like she was there, but had forgotten to speak. Lisa, are you there? A breath, close to the receiver, and then her voice, tremulous, unsteady.
David.
She sounded strange, kind of hoarse, congested, like maybe she had a cold.
David, is that you?
Yeah, Lisa, I'm sorry I haven't called.
David, you have to come home.
She interrupted, her voice suddenly desperate.
Now, please, hurry.
What? He sat up, the lingering effects of the beer neutralized by the desperation in her voice. Why? What is it? What's happened?
He says you have to come or...
Lisa, who are you talking about? Who says I have to come home?
There are men. They say if you don't come home now, they'll kill me.
Her voice broke into sobs, and he understood why she had sounded strange. She'd been crying. Whoever was with her had been there for some time. The realization brought both fury and a wave of nausea. She could have been calling him about this for days and he'd been ignoring her. Whatever was happening to her, he could have prevented it by just picking up his damn phone. Lisa, Lisa, who are these men? Have they hurt you?
Not much, but they say they will if you don't come home immediately.
Who are they?
I don't know.
Let me speak to them.
No, they won't speak to you on the phone. Just come, David, please, they...
She was cut off abruptly by a clattering sound. Lisa! David cried. Lisa! There was no reply, but over the line, he thought he heard someone breathing. Hello? He demanded. Who is this? No reply. Who the fuck are you? Listen, don't hurt her, okay? I'm coming. I'm on my way, all right? Whatever you want, you're in charge. I get it. Just don't... He stopped, thinking he'd heard the caller say something. He listened. Then the line went dead. Immediately, he selected Lisa's number and redialed. After a few rings, Lisa's voice, happy and bright, told him to leave a message. He hung up. For a few moments, he just sat there, numb with shock, trying to understand what had just happened, and the final thing he'd heard on the line still echoing in his mind. It hadn't been someone speaking. It had sounded more like someone sniggering. He looked again at the clock. It was now 2:15. He grabbed up his phone, leapt out of bed, and ran downstairs to book himself on the first available flight to London next morning. He could be in Brighton by late morning. And when he got there, whoever it was having such a good time terrifying Lisa, they were going to die. To be continued in Volume 4, Underwood and Finch, Underground. Yes, my friends, Volume 3 is over. Completed thanks to your sponsorship. And now, the adventure of Underwood and Finch will continue in Volume 4, starting later in the year and available exclusively from Patreon.com. An exclusive Patreon Q&A episode dedicated to Blood and Smoke will be out soon. There will be a posting at Patreon where you can ask your questions about the story, and my wife will grill me with them accordingly. So anything you want to know, please ask, and I shall answer. assuming, of course, that it's not a spoiler.
The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armour by Farid Farjad, courtesy of Taraneh Records, specialists in Persian music. Buy the track online at Amazon or iTunes, or go to www.taranehrecords.com. Sale links can be found at underwoodandflinch.com and mikebennettauthor.com. Other music on the podcast was performed and contributed by Andrew Rothman. And finally, my thanks to everyone who has stepped up and become a patron at patreon.com. I dedicate Underwood and Flinch Blood and Smoke to you, because without you, I fear it would have remained stalled forever at episode 6, and Underwood and Flinch volume 4 would never have come about at all. So thank you all. I hope you will continue to sponsor me as I edit the text of Underground and prepare it for podcast, and of course, partake of all the other little goodies that I will continue to podcast at Patreon to keep you amused in the meantime. But for me, for now, until the moon rises again over Underwood and Flinch, farewell.